So last time we were talking about random fields in 1D. Where the field is some object x of t. Whose mean we're taking to be zero just by assumption. In cosmology, we're just always happen to be interested in random fields whose mean is zero. Whose two-point expectation value in real space is assumed to be time translation invariant, but otherwise unconstrained, so that it's equal to some arbitrary function of the separation t minus t prime, which is, so let's say, by the assumption of time translation symmetry. In Fourier space, the two-point correlator of two arbitrary Fourier coefficients, omega and omega prime, the way time translation works in the Fourier domain is that you get a delta function on the right-hand side. Where the function P of omega here is called the power spectrum is defined by this equation in the same way that zeta is the correlation function is defined by the previous equation. And we had a theorem that the two are Fourier transforms of each other. It makes sense that they should contain equivalent information, since you can, if you start with the two-point function in the time domain, you can take some Fourier transforms and get an expression for the two-point function in the Fourier domain. We were working out a few examples. We had worked out the case of white noise. Let's see. Well, one example we showed is that if if you take the derivative of a random field, then the power spectrum is omega squared times the power spectrum that you started with. Another example that we did is the example of a random field which is white noise. This is the simplest possible random field where the value of x at every time is independent of every other time. The correlation function in the time domain, in other words, is a delta function or proportional to a delta function. Then the power spectrum is constant in omega. It just means every Fourier mode has the same variance regardless of its frequency. So here's another example, which is if you consider a random walk. Then the power spectrum of a random walk can be derived in several ways, but a really efficient derivation is to observe that the random walk is the antiderivative of white noise. So if I started with a white noise time series, which is just a bunch of independent Gaussian random numbers, and then I take its antiderivative, then as I integrate along, I'm just accumulating Gaussian random, a new Gaussian random number in every time step. In other words, I get a random walk. So by the same argument that showed that adding a derivative gives omega squared in the power spectrum, taking the antiderivative would give omega to the minus 2. And then I have to multiply in the power spectrum of white noise, which is a constant. So the a random walk has power spectrum proportional to omega to the minus 2. A case that's intermediate between a random walk and white noise is the case where the power spectrum is proportional to omega to the minus 1. And this case also has a name and an interpretation. This is called a scale invariant power spectrum. I'll show up a computer plot later. But you could imagine something that's, just to draw a blackboard cartoon, something that's sort of intermediate in predictability between a random walk and a white noise power spectrum. You know, something that sort of fluctuates around in a way which is correlated from place to place, but not as correlated as a random walk. Now, scale invariant means that the field, if I have a random realization of the field in some time interval, and then I take a subinterval and blow it up so that it's the size of the original interval with no scaling applied on the y-axis, then that magnified version of the time series is statistically equivalent, statistically indistinguishable from the original. And this is something that you'll show in the homework. Omega to the minus 1 is the exponent that you need in order to have that scale invariance property.
What do you mean by antiderivative?
Just integral.
Sorry?
Just the integral.
Okay.
If I take a white noise, if x of t were white noise, and then I define a time series from it starting at minus infinity, say, then this would be a random walk. I want to go through a few. There are a lot of examples of calculations in cosmology involving random fields. So I want to go through a few representative examples. So one thing that we sometimes do is apply some filtering operation to a random field. So imagine that I have a random time series with some power spectrum px of omega. And then I boxcar filter it. What that means is that I choose some timescale capital T, and I define a new time series y so that the value of y at every point is equal to x integrated over an interval of width of length t centered at little t. So you can imagine moving an interval or a boxcar over the data and just taking averages in that moving boxcar. And what that would do is it would be some sort of filter that is removing small scale power and keeping track of like a running average or a baseline. A so-called low-pass filter, because it's 1 in the limit of a low-frequency Fourier mode and 0 in the limit of a high-frequency Fourier mode. So let's work out quantitatively what happens here. Now, one thing that's going to turn out to be true is that, so in these examples of the derivative and the antiderivative, we were applying some linear operator to the time series, which turned out to be diagonal in Fourier space. In other words, it just is applying some multiple in multiplier in Fourier space, which is a function of omega, but it doesn't mix Fourier mode omega into Fourier mode omega prime. And that's true because we've been considering linear operators that commute with time translation. That's why it's true. This is something that comes up in quantum mechanics if I have some operator that commutes with a symmetry, then it follows that that operator preserves the eigenspaces corresponding to that symmetry. In this case, the eigenfunctions of time translation are Fourier modes. That's why an operator, and this is another example of an operator that commutes with time translation, this boxcar filter, So one thing that we can say in advance is that if we write this operation down in the Fourier domain, it's just going to look like y of omega equals x of omega times some function of omega that we're trying to compute. So with that comment, which, of course, you can do the calculation without knowing that in advance, but I think it's helpful. This upper limit should have been t plus big T over 2, of course. So let's work out what happens first at the level of the field, and then we'll just square to get the result for the power spectrum. So the way that I did this is I took the definition of y of t, and I decided to expand x in Fourier modes first. Let's write that as the integral of d omega over 2 pi times x tilde of omega e to the I omega t. T prime. And then you can do the T prime integral. And you turn out to get this. And then you can read off from this expression. This expression happens to be written in a way where you can read off the Fourier transform of 1. So by this little calculation, this boxcar filtering operation in the time domain, in the Fourier domain, looks like this. As expected, it's just multiplying every Fourier mode of the time series by some frequency-dependent multiplier. And so it follows that the power spectrum of y is related to the power spectrum of x by the square of this factor. The power spectrum is defined as the expectation value of the square of the Fourier mode. One comment here is that because it's generally true that if I start with a Gaussian random variable and apply a linear operation, I get another Gaussian random variable. That was something that we showed last time for a random vector. But it's also true for random fields in any number of dimensions. This statement that relating the power spectra is true whether the field is Gaussian or not. But it's also true that if I start with a Gaussian random field and apply a linear operation such as this one, I get another Gaussian random field with some power spectrum that I can compute. And a lot of the physics in cosmology kind of works this way, where I have some Gaussian randomness. And then there's some physics that's evolving it. And if that physics is linear, then you're processing the power spectrum into something more complicated. So you can get more Gaussian fluctuations that are still Gaussian random, but with some more complicated power spectrum. One more example, which I really like because it's very representative of what happens in cosmology, is that I want to process a Gaussian random field by some physical time evolution. So if I consider the wave equation in 1 plus 1 dimension, where CS is a free parameter, sound speed. So consider this equation and suppose that as initial conditions, I say that phi of 0 comma x is a Gaussian random field with some known power spectrum. P0. I decided to write the wave number as k because I'm now thinking of this as a one-dimensional random field with a spatial coordinate rather than a time coordinate. Suppose that to complete the boundary conditions or the initial conditions for the second order differential equation, suppose that the time derivative is assumed to be zero. I can evolve that initial data, and then I'll get some, and then if I take a snapshot at some later time t, then I know by linearity, and because I haven't broken spatial translations, that this will be a Gaussian random field. This implies that a snapshot taken at some later time t will be a Gaussian random field with a power spectrum p sub t. Let's just compute how p sub t is related to the input power spectrum p sub zero. So to solve this equation, I'll take a Fourier transform in the x direction, a spatial Fourier transform, but leave the time coordinate un-Fourier transform. So defining phi sub t of k to be the integral of dx. Okay. In Fourier space, this differential operator just becomes minus k squared. So in Fourier space, the wave equation reads plus k squared. So each Fourier mode just behaves as a harmonic oscillator with frequency kcs. Given the initial conditions that the derivative is zero, but the initial condition is some arbitrary function of k, which will be a Gaussian random number, the solution to this equation is each Fourier mode is just an independent harmonic oscillator that starts with zero velocity. And so its evolution in time is just given by a cosine. So that implies that the power spectrum in Fourier space, a snapshot at time t is related to the snapshot at time zero by multiplying by this k-dependent factor. And so just as in the other examples, in the power spectrum, you get the square of this factor. So if I started with featureless power spectrum in the initial conditions, then at some later time t, the physics would have processed that power spectrum into one with bumps. And imprinted a characteristic scale that tells me something about the physics. In this case, the characteristic scale is the product CS times T, or rather 1 over that product. And this is very representative of what happens in the CMB. This is the reason why, as everyone here knows, I'm sure, the power spectrum of the CMB has acoustic peaks. The physics of CMB formation starts with featureless initial conditions that have a featureless power spectrum, and this series of peaks is imprinted by acoustic physics just like this. And there's some new scale that shows up that tells you something about how long that processing took and what its characteristic sound speed was. The full system of differential equations determining the CMB is, of course, more complicated than this. There are many species of particle, give multiple species, so there are multiple fields, and there are metric degrees of freedom. GR effects are important. But the idea is the same. Okay. Now I want to So with these little calculations, let's just sort of give you an idea of how these calculations with random fields work. I want to write down a few properties of random fields, which are all, I'm just going to write them down because they're all very easy to derive. They're all like one-line calculations. So first off, I'm going to, we're generally going to be interested in fields which are real valued in the time domain. Does anyone know offhand if what constraint that imposes on the Fourier transform x tilde? X tilde is still a complex number because the Fourier transform has the e to the I. But there is some constraint on x tilde, which is equivalent to x being real valued in the time domain. This comes up in the This comes up all the time when you write computer code that deals with Fourier transforms. If you for a real valued field, the Fourier mode at frequency minus omega is not independent of not an independent complex number from the frequency, the Fourier mode at positive omega. They're complex conjugates of each other. So if you're thinking about the Fourier transform of a real valued function, you can just pay attention to the positive frequency modes. The negative frequency modes are just their complex conjugates. And this is easy to derive just by starring the both sides. Writing down the definition of x of omega and starring both sides. Some more, let's say that's property one. Property two, which is also a very super short calculation, is that the correlation function is always even. Same is true for the power spectrum. I think I may have implicitly been using some of these properties earlier, but I would just want to make sure they're listed. Finally, the power spectrum is a real number. A few more. So here's something that like almost never comes up, but oh, wait, never mind. Skipping ahead, here's something that actually does come up. You might see this expression in a calculation. The product of two Fourier modes without the star. In that case, putting in the star would be equivalent to flipping one of the signs by the first property. So what you get is the power spectrum times the delta function at the sum of the two frequencies. This is an alternate definition of the power spectrum that you'll sometimes see. The two definitions are equivalent in view of property one. So here are some things that rarely come up, except for one specific thing that I want to talk about next. So I have this expectation value for the product of two complex x of omegas with no star and another expression with the star. Suppose that I just want to unpack that into real and complex parts. So if I just want to calculate the expectation value between the real part of one Fourier mode and the real part of another Fourier mode, well, that's that can be worked out by writing the real part like this, and similarly for the other factor. And then when you multiply everything out, you'll get expectation values, you know, that have some of them have stars and some of them don't. That can all be computed with the formulas that we've written down so far. And what you get, it turns out, is this. So this time the delta function, there's a factor of 1/2. And the delta function is, you get the combination of delta functions, which is symmetric under flipping the sign of either omega or omega prime, as it must be, because the real part of x of omega is equal to the real part of x of minus omega. A few more. I'm going to take the real part the expectation value of a real part times an imaginary part is 0, and two imaginary parts I get the same right hand side as in number 6. Okay. So 6 through 8 here are rarely useful. It's usually easiest to just work with complex numbers. But there's one particular thing that I want to talk about next, or I'm going to use those formulas. Let's think about the problem of simulating a Gaussian random field. I like to think about it on the computer. So on the computer, I'd have some finite box, or we're in 1D, so some finite time series and finite sampling. And I want to just populate these samples with Gaussian random numbers. So let's assume that simulated in Gaussian random field with known power spectrum, or equivalently known. Known correlation functions, yeah. The last time we talked about a situation where for a Gaussian random vector, not a Gaussian random field, you might have some covariance matrix which is non-diagonal in one basis and therefore non-trivial to simulate. But you could always diagonalize, you know, rotate to a basis where the covariance matrix was diagonal. And then it's trivial to simulate n independent Gaussian random numbers with variance lambda I, and then rotate back. And the analog of that for a random field is that in the time domain, if I'm thinking about populating this time series, the two-point function is non-diagonal. Generally, the correlation function will be non-zero, so the correlation between two different samples is non-zero. But if I think about doing the simulation in the Fourier domain, where I am just trying to populate the Fourier mode is some finite sequence of wave numbers, 2 pi over t, 4 pi over t, and so on. And I want to populate this array with, omega. With complex numbers x of omega, then I'm in the basis where the covariance is diagonal. I keep mixing up my k's and omegas, so let me make this k into an omega. And just to make that totally explicit, if you imagine these x's are complex numbers. So if you imagine thinking of the random field, rather than being a collection of n complex numbers, a collection of two n real numbers, there would be some lowest Fourier mode that has a real and imaginary part. A second lowest Fourier mode that has a real and imaginary part, and so on. If I put all the Fourier modes of the field, if I think of them as a big vector with two n components, then we've shown that the covariance matrix of this vector is completely diagonal. The different Fourier modes don't mix. And the real and the imaginary parts don't mix either. That's what I was getting at with property 6 through 8 here. Like property 7 is telling me that there are zeros here in the covariance matrix. And just to be totally explicit, I'm only considering the only putting the positive frequency Fourier modes into this vector, since the negative frequency modes are just their complex conjugates, and I don't need to independently simulate those. And there's a factor of 2 here that came out in the right-hand side of 6 and 8. Okay. So in Fourier space, a Gaussian random field is really just a collection of a bunch of independent Gaussian random numbers for the real and imaginary parts of every Fourier mode, sampled with the appropriate variance, remembering to put in this factor of 2. Okay. One more comment is that, one difference between this case and this case is that in this case, if someone just hands me an n by n covariance matrix, you might not know in advance which basis diagonalizes it. You'd have to feed it to some numerical routine to do the diagonalization and get the rotation matrix. In this case, you know in advance that the basis that diagonalizes the covariance matrix is always the Fourier basis. You could think of the matrix that takes you from this sequence of time samples, some array of length n, some vector of length n, to this vector of length n, as that Fourier transform as being like a big rotation in a function space. And that's always the rotation that takes you to the basis where the covariance is diagonal. There would be no need to, in the random field case, to explicitly diagonalize to figure out what basis you need to be in. The assumption of time translation symmetry implies that the Fourier basis is always the basis that makes the covariance diagonal. Okay. So now I want to talk about random fields in n dimensions, which is really just a matter of changing every integral from dx to d to the nx, except for one new definition that I want to make. So in n dimensions, the first thing I want to say is that generally, when we think about random fields in n dimensions, we, unless stated otherwise, we'll be assuming the n-dimensional spatial translation symmetry. Plus rotational symmetry. So for example, the correlation function If I were only assuming translation symmetry, then the most general right-hand side allowed by symmetry would be a function of the vector separation of the two points. In other words, a function of n real variables. But if I also assume rotation symmetry, then that function doesn't depend on which direction the vector separation between the points points in. It must be a function of their length, only their length. So in n dimensions under assumption of full symmetry, the correlation function is still a function of one variable. And same is true for the power spectrum. Translation invariance on its own would imply that there has to be this n-dimensional delta function on the right-hand side. If I also assume rotation invariance, but if I was only assuming translation invariance, then the prefactor would be a function of all n components of k. If rotation invariance is assumed, then I get an absolute value here. So the power spectrum is still a function of one variable. The relation between the two in one dimension, these were Fourier transforms of each other. In n dimensions, the relation looks like this. So even though these are functions of one variable, they're still related by the n-dimensional Fourier transform. The n-dimensional Fourier transform has the property that if I give it a function of n variables, which is spherically symmetric, then even though the Fourier transform is, you know, it's an n-dimensional Fourier transform, it's defined with this non-spherically symmetric plane wave, the result is a function which is also spherically symmetric. So these are 1D functions related by the n-dimensional Fourier transform. And then another little property, which you'll show in your homework, is that scale invariant power spectra are going to come up a lot, as you'll see. So in one dimension, a scale invariant power spectrum was proportional to omega to the minus 1. And in n dimensions, it turns out the scale invariant case is the case which is proportional to k to the minus n, where n is the number of dimensions. Now, by the way, this can be seen by dimensional analysis. I haven't, I never explicitly said what the units were yet, but if phi has, if phi is a dimensionless field, then with my conventions for the Fourier transform, the Fourier transform phi tilde has units of n volume. So the Fourier transform adds an n volume to the units, and the inverse Fourier transform removes it. Therefore, the power spectrum, so if I look at this equation and ask what units does the power spectrum need to have for it to be dimensionally consistent, I have two factors of n volume here. The delta function always has the inverse units of its argument. So this, I have n wave numbers here. So the delta function has units of inverse wave number, or n volume. And therefore, the power spectrum has units of volume. Power spectrum in n dimensions, P of k has units length to the n. Therefore, if the power spectrum is proportional to k to the minus n, then the coefficient sitting in front would be dimensionless. It's only true if it's k to the minus n. If it were any other power, then the coefficient would have dimensions. And so the scale invariant case is the case where the the parameter in the power spectrum doesn't have any dimensions. There's no preferred scale. There's no parameter with units of a length scale appearing in the power spectrum. Okay. And then one more definition. That comes up. So in cosmology, you'll sometimes see, instead of, especially in plots, when the power spectrum is plotted, instead of seeing the power spectrum P, you'll often see a different quantity plotted called delta squared, which is just related to P by some factors. If L was two-dimensional. Or in 3D, now would be a good time to mention that as a cosmologist, I'm hardwired to write wave numbers as L in two dimensions and K in three dimensions. I just want to motivate. These are just definitions. Delta squared is the same thing as P with this factor. I just want to motivate where these factors come from. And where they come from is that suppose you have a random field and you're just interested in its variance. That is, I take any point, take the field value at that point, and take the expectation value of its square. That is equal to the integral of the power spectrum with a d to the n k. If you know the power spectrum and you want to calculate the variance, 2 pi to the n. You can easily calculate this. You can write out phi of x, Fourier transform both of these factors of phi of x, and take the expectation value using the definition of the power spectrum. Another way to see it would be to note that the left-hand side here is just the correlation function evaluated at zero separation. According to this Wiener-Kinchin theorem, generally the correlation function is the Fourier transform of the power spectrum. And if the separation is zero, then that would just mean that the e to the I factor here has become 1 since the r is 0. So one way or another, the variance of the field is just the integral of the power spectrum. And if I have a integral in n dimensions whose argument is spherically symmetric, it's natural to write that integral down in polar coordinates. So this would look like, so if I integrate out the angles, then in 2D, I could write the result this way. L. I'm calling the wave number L in 2D. Instead of writing it as DL, I'm going to write it as an integral involving log L. And in 3D, I could write it this way. In 2D, when I do that angular integral, I get a factor of 2 pi, the circumference of the circle, divided by a 2 pi squared. So that's where this 2 pi comes from. And then in 3D, I have 4 pi, the area of the sphere, divided by 2 pi cubed, which gives a total denominator of 2 pi squared. And so these are just the where the definitions of delta come from. Delta squared is just defined to be whatever quantity you integrate against the log of the wave number to get the total variance of the field. And the reason that's a useful definition is that if you're staring at a plot of delta, if you want to interpret the numerical value of the power spectrum, then if you're staring at a plot with wave number on a log scale, and you've chosen to plot delta squared instead of p, then you can kind of integrate in your head, like if let's say it looks like a big peak, and it peaks at 100, and this is of order 1, then I can say, well, this integral is about 100, and so I can interpret the axis of this plot as telling me that the typical fluctuation size is the square root of 100, or the variance of the field is around 100, and so the typical fluctuation size is the square root of that, or 10. So that just integrating this plot in your head tells you the variance of the field. This quantity, delta squared, also is dimensionless. The power spectrum has units of volume, but delta squared is dimensionless. And it has the property that it is constant for a scale invariant field, so that k dependence in this plot would tell you about the deviation from scale invariance. The n-dimensional case is not very different from the one-dimensional case. I just wanted to introduce this definition. That's all I have to say about random fields on the blackboard. And I'm going to show some slides. Well, thanks, whoever turned off the lights. It needs a minute to warm up. I made a lot of slides, so I'll show half the slides today and the other half next time. Great. All right. So, there is very little in these slides that hasn't already been said in math, but I personally find it helpful to look at the pictures. Just to remind you, the correlation function and the power spectrum contain the same information and are just alternate representations for the two-point statistics of a random field. Here are their definitions, and they're related by the power spectrum. In these slides, I've decided to use the power spectrum throughout, but you could just as well use the correlation function. There are a lot of Gaussian fields in cosmology, and if the field is Gaussian, then the power spectrum completely determines the statistics. But I just want to emphasize that that's not always true. For example, one place where you do get non-Gaussian fields in cosmology is at late times after nonlinear effects have become important. Even if the universe is Gaussian at early times, and as long as the fluctuations are small, and linear perturbation theory is a good approximation, things stay Gaussian. But eventually, the perturbations become big because of gravitational collapse. Nonlinear effects are important. And then you get fields like this. Here's a Gaussian field with the same power spectrum, showing you that the power spectrum is really not capturing everything that's going on in this picture. But for the CMB, it would. generally at early times or at late times on large length scales. Gaussian statistics are a good approximation. For example, the CMB is just observed, even if we didn't have a theory that predicted Gaussianness. It's just empirically observed to be Gaussian to 0.1% or better. That's roughly the observational constraint on Gaussianness of the CMB. A Gaussian field is easy to simulate. If you want to do it on the computer, you just you have a box where you're trying to simulate the field. You do the simulation in Fourier space, loop over every Fourier mode in the box, and initialize the real and complex parts of that complex number, phi of k, to random Gaussian numbers whose variance is given by evaluating the power spectrum at the appropriate wave number, not forgetting about the factor of two and the fact that when you get to the negative frequency modes, you don't simulate them. You take the complex conjugate of the positive frequency mode that you previously simulated, because you want to get a real field when you take the Fourier transform. And then you take the Fourier transform to go back to real space so you can make a picture. The point I'm trying, and I'm going to, wrote code to do this, and I'm going to show examples in the slides. But the point I'm trying to make here is that you do not need complicated software to do this. You can write some like 10-line Python function. So here's some examples of one-dimensional Gaussian fields with power law spectra. So you can compare the case of white noise. The blue curve is just independently simulating a random number for each time sample, and then the plotting script has connected them by lines. And the green curve is a random walk. And the scale invariant case with exponent minus one is some random field that whose level of correlation from place to place is intermediate between these two cases. I thought this example was sort of fun. I took, still in 1D, I took a constant power spectrum, i.e. white noise, so you'll see some white noise in the plots I'm about to show. And then I just added a bump at a particular frequency. And that might be a sharp peak in the power spectrum or a wide peak in the power spectrum. And I'm just trying to give some intuition for what the power spectrum means. And so a sharp peak would look like a pure sinusoid plus some white noise, because this isn't at zero, in the limit where the power spectrum contains a delta function. Then you would just be simulating one Fourier mode, and therefore you would just get a pure sinusoid in the time domain. If you widen that peak, what happens is that it's not a pure sinusoid anymore. Like these peaks have different heights, and they also have different widths and can spill into each other. But there's still a characteristic scale. This peak is imprinting some characteristic time scale, which is like 1 over the value of k at the peak, or maybe pi over the value of k at the peak, which is very clearly visible in the data. It's just not as sharply defined as in the top plot. If I kept widening this peak, it would look more and more like white noise, and the power spectrum would be more and more constant, and it would be harder and harder to see the characteristic scale in the plot. Here are some two-dimensional examples. This should not be labeled white noise. This should be called blue noise. Here's the scale invariant case, a power spectrum proportional to L to the minus 2 in two dimensions. This plot has the property that if I were to take a little sub box and magnify it to the size of the original box, it would look statistically indistinguishable from the original. And then if I start to tilt the power spectrum away from scale invariance, you can see what happens. In this case, I have more power on large scales relative to the scale invariant case. And you can see that there are larger features compared to the scale invariant case. There are larger fields on features on large scales, like this big hot spot looks brighter, but suppressed features on small scales. The small scale fuzz in the plot is suppressed. And this plot is mislabeled. It should not say white noise. blue noise is what you get if you're sort of in between scale invariant and white noise. That's, I don't know who picks the colors, but that's what it's called. You could say the opposite is happening, where you're sort of sharpening the small scale features and suppressing power on large scales. More plots. Here's what a delta function, so in 1D, a delta function would in the power spectrum would mean that only one Fourier mode is non-zero and the time series is a pure sinusoid. In 2D, a delta function means that the two-dimensional wave number has a ring of values where it's allowed to be non-zero. And when I combine Fourier modes that have the same magnitude, whose wave vectors have the same magnitude but different directions, they can sort of interfere with each other and make something that is a lot more complicated than a plane wave. But there's still a well-defined characteristic scale that's easy to pick out visually. There's some scale where the power spectrum peaks, and in the spatial domain, all of these hot and cold spots sort of have the same characteristic size. One more example. If I take a scale invariant power spectrum and just add a cutoff, so I take the scale invariant power spectrum and then I just exponentially suppress power on small scales, then that just smooths it out so that these two fields look the same on large scales. This one has been smoothed out so that the small scale features are absent. Here's the CMB power spectrum. This arises by linearly processing a featureless power spectrum. In cosmology, the initial conditions have relatively featureless power spectra, as we'll talk about in a bit. There's enough physics between the initial conditions at scale factor zero and the time when the CMB is formed to imprint a lot of interesting physics and new scales on the power spectrum. As we saw in that example with the wave equation. In this case, there are two. The physics is a lot more complicated. Just to quantify the level of complicatedness, the software packages that compute this curve, and it has to be done in software. The differential equations are way too complicated to solve analytically. Are something on the order of 100,000 lines of code just to define and integrate the set of differential equations that you need to integrate. So this is actually a really, the details of this are actually really complicated. So there's a lot going in, a lot of physics going into this plot. The two features that really stand out are there's an acoustic scale, a scale of the peak, and there's a damping scale below which power is exponentially suppressed. If you have this curve, if you've computed it numerically, then I want to emphasize that if you go through this procedure with populating the Fourier modes and taking the Fourier transform, then you get a simulation of the, you can simulate the CMB in a way which, as far as we know, is perfect. This would be indistinguishable from the real sky. I was sort of curious whether you could see these features in the map. So it's easy to see this feature, the damping scale. If I compare the CMB to a scale invariant power spectrum, it's obvious that there's some, it's visually apparent that there's some scale here below which power is absent, unlike the scale invariant case that has power on all scales. But if I compare the CMB to just a scale invariant power spectrum with a cutoff, so this would have no acoustic, this would have no peaks. They do look a little different by eye. Like, I can see some statistical difference here. But I think it would be a stretch to say that there's like a well-defined acoustic scale in this plot. So I decided that it's easy to see the damping scale by eye, but hard to see this scale. I was hoping to make a plot that would sort of convince you that this scale is really visual and well-defined in the CMB. It certainly is very visual and well-defined in the power spectrum, but I guess the your eye is not a very good power spectrum estimator. When you look at this map, it's hard to see all the structure. Okay, so I have a bunch more slides that I'm going to show tomorrow, but I'll stop there.